Hello, and welcome to the Joffrion Fellows podcast, a public humanities project for Miami University's Humanities Center. My name is Sydney Chun, and I'm one of six undergraduate Joffrion Fellows for the 2019-2020 school year. As part of the Altman Lecture Series on Time and Temporality, we are interviewing various experts in an attempt to illuminate interdisciplinary perspectives on the nature of time, how we think about it, and our place in it. In this episode, we'll introduce you to Dr. Matthew Burtner, an Alaskan-born composer and sound artist who works extensively with ecoacoustics. His music and research explores, as he says, embodiment, ecology, polytemporality, and noise. We were honored to have had the opportunity to discuss how he melds music and the Arctic climate into beautiful works of sound, as well as his self-developed process. He has composed three evening-length intermedia environmental opera and theater works, including Oikuik Tulugak, or Winter Raven, Kuik, and the world's first climate change opera, Oxalok, as well as several solo albums that all bring together environmental science, engineering, and of course, music. Dr. Burtner is the creator of the Nomads Telematic System, the Mice Human-Computer Ensemble and Orchestra, the Mega Saxophone Augmented Instrument, and a number of ecoacoustic approaches that he employs in his collection and performance of sounds. He uses music as a means to compress large timescales, a glacier's 100,000-year history, for example, into shorter musical experiences that humans can understand. This decentralization of human time is at the crux of his work and overall message, as we'll hear momentarily. As Dr. Burtner discusses, music is a time-based phenomenon, and our experience of sounds is actually scientific, mathematical even.
So music's a time-based art form. And I spoke a little about this last night in the talk, the idea that music is about sound, and sound is made up of vibrations, and those are time-based phenomena. So an impulse in an elastic medium propagates a waveform across a material, whether that's the air, and we hear that through our ears, or through the table, or through water, or whatever. So there's a time function of sound, and it's the speed of sound. And so the speed of sound is also dependent on the medium that it's propagating through. So its speed of sound in air is about 330 meters per second. That's a distance, that's a time delay that we can measure. So when I say something, my body disturbs the space, and the waveform propagates across the molecules of air, each molecule transmitting the energy to the next molecule until it dissipates. But in a very, very short time, it reaches your ear, you know? And so there is this time function of sound where we can, you know, things echo off of a surface and come back and you hear the delay, and that is the time function. But then it goes away, dissipates, and it's gone.
But he goes deeper than that. How can we understand music as more than just a collection of sounds? Where does the coherence come from, and how do we know? For Dr. Burtner, the power of music goes beyond physicality. It's a matter of temporality.
With music, we're working with that sound, that time medium, but we're also organizing it in relationship to a listener's mind. And the mind is you know, an important medium for music as well, because it has our memories. And so, you know, when you listen to a melody, you hear the first note and then you hear the second note. But when you hear the second note, you don't hear the first note anymore. It's gone. It's just gone. Like that energy is dissipated. It's gone forever. But it's like now moved into your brain. And so you can hear the continuity of the melody and remember the note before and relate the next note to it, and then future notes similarly construct together into these strings of memory. And that's like how we can understand music, which is pretty cool because it's very much alive and sounding in our brains, even though it's gone in the real world, in the vibrating world. And so that's interesting, right? We're music is working on these multiple scales of temporality. One, the vibrating time of the space around us, and then one, the memory of the person.
Music also has a unique way of triggering memories in individuals as it transcends the immediate. It connects with us and has the ability to fill us up, seeming to communicate with our past.
That melody that you hear as a sequence of notes in your mind and can relate also connects to other memories that you have. So it's not on its own. So for example, if you listen to the melody, it makes you feel a certain way, perhaps because you listened to that same melody when you were in another place in another time. And it reminds you in some way of that other place, another time. The song makes you feel like you're back in this other place, another time. So it also has this interesting kind of large-scale temporality dialogue going on with our brains. As a composer, you're working with these vibrations that are happening in the real world. You're also kind of creating forms in the mind of the listener and thinking, how might that interact with their own memories, which of course you don't know. It's imagining the listener and, you know, what she might be hearing and how that might relate to some memory in the past or not. So it's kind of like potentials.
But as you may be thinking, as we did, because Dr. Bertner's work relies on capturing sounds directly from nature, are there elements that may be lost in translation? Is it possible that by expressing nature through a different timescale, that is music, that it may actually be out of time with the data collected? These questions, as Dr. Bertner explains, are not only central to his work, but to how we think about music itself.
Well, my whole music theory is about embedding natural systems into music. And what's exciting to me about that is that I'm trying to decenter humans. I think we're too self-centered, and that's basically why we're in this situation we're in. I mean, we could be numerous and living sustainably with the planet, but we're not. And we're not because I think we're just very self-centered. And we think we have this, you know, idea of the outside world and we're not part of it, you know? And this is, and that's, so my thought with music is, if I can make music that doesn't sound like it, it's for, like, exactly for people, that it sort of puts them out of their selves and makes them, you know, a little bit uncomfortable, that is, you know, because it's not comfortable to go outside, but that they could get used to living in that place, and so that you don't have to feel like, you know, we have to control everything and change the world. It could be what it is and not exactly right for us. Like, that's okay. It's quite amazing that this world supports our lives. Like, that we can actually just breathe and live and, you know, stand up. And, I mean, all these things that we can do, the planet sustains us. It doesn't, you know, freeze us or boil us. But it's not for us. Like, that's just, we're just lucky that it does that. It doesn't have to do that. Most planets wouldn't be so hospitable. But just because it does sustain our lives doesn't mean that it's for us, you know? And so I think we don't respect and value that that relationship, we're part of the world and it's taking care of us. And it does that by, you know, grace, not because it has to, not because it's somehow created by us. So the music is like that too. It's like, this music that uses environmental forms is like the form of the wind. Well, the wind is nice to listen to, and people know the wind. So that's a kind of, you know, it's like a melody, kind of a meta melody. Everyone's heard the wind because we live in the world and it has, you know, moving air. So if I put the wind inside the music, then there's something that's familiar about it. But at the same time, there's something very unusual about that, because most human music doesn't use the patterns of wind as the rhythms and the organism principle. And that sort of thing that we hear as noise and chaos doesn't match expectations of what music should be. And so that's kind of uncomfortable. So there's something familiar about it, and there's something unfamiliar about it. And that's by design for me. Like, you know, things go on in the pace of the environment. Not really, but it's like moving in that direction.
To illustrate his point, Dr. Burtner discusses making a musical piece about the tides as an example of the necessary mediation between environmental and musical timescales.
Well, the tides are, you know, every 6 hours, so that's a long... If I want to do just one tide, you know, I'm going to be there for 12 hours as the ebb and the flood, and so... I don't know who's going to want to sit and listen to my piece for 12 hours, right? So it needs to kind of fit into music, the world of music, that is, where people are sitting in an audience and they can listen to it. I mean, we could make something. We could put it on headphones and put it up online, and people could just enjoy it, like, throughout the day, maybe, like, listen to tidal music throughout the day. That could be cool. But mostly that's not going to work for a concert piece. So there's some practical aspects. We can't really put the tidal time scale into music. But we could, like, you know, compress it somewhat into a scale, like reduce the time. Maybe it's not 6 hours, but 6 minutes. And you could make cycles of 6 minutes in music. It would still be a long piece, but, you know, that might start getting at the form of tidal change. So there's a mediation, finding the scales of time that are acceptable for the whole kind of medium of music, but also are unexpected in their musical shapes. And so that's about decentering the human in the music. So if you felt, like in Oxalock, that sometimes things were going on too long, or that it was a little bit like, where are we going or something, that's a feeling that I like try to compose in the music, that it should feel, and I'm always thinking, how long is too long? Like, I want it to feel too long, because I want you to feel like, where's this going? And then realize, oh, this isn't exactly for me. It's taking its own pace. Like, it's like when you're outside and you're cold, and you're like, oh, I wish it would warm up, but it doesn't warm up. It's still cold. I mean, for me, I like that, because it's a reminder that the world's not for us. It doesn't have to support us.
So if there's a temporality of the tides and environmental processes can be captured in musical time, wouldn't the isolation of the Arctic have a temporality as well? To this point, generally, Dr. Burtner disagreed, stating that it's really more a matter of space. But thinking about the sound of that space that must be captured in music revealed that, in fact, time is a necessary element.
You know, I try to describe it in Oxalock as a, like a kind of closeness and distance. Sometimes I think of the free imagination as being a place where you don't have any reverberation. So, like, if you're just in an open space, like the Arctic tundra, and you know, call out, your voice doesn't come back at you. You don't hear it. It just keeps going out. It's just dead. It goes away as far as it can, and then it dissipates. You know, there's no, like, response. And I sometimes think of that as like that open space as being connected to free imagination. But temporality, I guess I've thought of it more like spatially. And then there's this other thing where in Oxlock, she talks about putting the hood up of her parka. And so you're like encased in this kind of hood, and then the wind's blowing around and everything's like pressing inward. So you just feel like you're pushed into your mind by the environment. So it's this weird kind of juxtaposition of openness and closedness, and how somehow that's freeing. But I can't say that I know if that's exactly a temporal phenomenon. It seems more spatial to me. Even though, again, it's a little hard in music to separate time and space because of the whole way that, as we discussed before, how things, you know, if there's a time delay as things propagate, and then the memory and all that stuff. So they're definitely interrelated. You know, I think in some ways, like, your study of temporality could also be a study of space.
You may remember the discussion we shared with you in our previous episode when we interviewed geologist Dr. Marcia Bjornerud. She brought up the idea of geologic time as Earth's history preserved in rock layers. We wondered if Dr. Burtner would agree, and if he felt that the environments that he captures with sound have a temporal aspect to them as well.
I love that idea, because I've spent a lot of time with rocks too, and I wrote this piece, for example, in called The Catalog of Roughness, and it's a piece for rock, and you take one rock and you rub the other rock with it, and so it's like reading the surface of the rock, and so you read the erosion patterns that have been left in that rock, and it's different for every place. And as you scratch it, it like, you know, we hear it, it's just like shh, but it's actually according to the surface of the rock. And you can, and when you read that, then you can read it again and again. You can do it slowly, you can do it quickly, but the patterns are always the same. They're just stretched or compressed. And the rock is like I was talking about the snow. It's a, you know, it changes more slowly, the rock, but it still is, you know, eroding, interacting with the environment, and part of those, just the dynamics are more, it seems, you know, fixed to us, but it's actually quite dynamic. But it's a lot like reading the snow. You can read the rocks too.
So just as Dr. Bjornerud reads rocks, Dr. Bertner reads snow. The translation for him, though, is of course musical. He describes this as a sort of time-scaling exercise that requires accessing different temporalities through different materials, as he puts it.
The idea that you're accessing different dimensions of temporality through different materials is super interesting. So like the snow, you know, at first, when we just talk about the snow on the surface and the buildup, we're talking about, you know, days, weeks, months, but not years, because that snow all melts in the summer. So days, weeks, months of time, and the material is telling you about days, weeks, months. But when you deal with rocks, you know, then you're reading back much further in time. And in my work, it was the glaciers. It was, you know, the snow becomes glaciers. So days, weeks, months turns into, you know, years, decades, hundreds of years, 10,000 years, and even, which I haven't worked on a glacier, a million years old, but, you know, millions of years, really. And that's the scale you're in on rocks.
The culmination of Dr. Bertner's Arctic music came as the world's first climate change opera, Oxalok, in 2012. In the interest of time, we asked him if he felt there was a change in the power and meaning of it over the last 8 years.
That's right. It definitely has changed. So there's an aspect to the piece that is, you know, extremely dated already. I mean, the piece was really complete in 2010. So all the data and all the stuff that went into it is 2010. So we knew about 2007, but we didn't know, you know, about 2012. You know, that was still coming at that time, and, you know, and every year since then, basically.
Yet Dr. Bertner acknowledges that Oxalok was before its time. It was telematic, innovative, radical, and as such, people needed time to understand it. At the time, 2012, it was just such a new idea.
Right, because it's years old now. On the other hand, I think when it came out, people were really not ready for that yet. It was a very kind of unusual, radical way of, first of all, creating music altogether, then collaborating with scientists the way that it did. You know, that was also unusual, and focusing on climate change. Plus, it was a telematic piece, so it also was the first telematic opera. So, you know, that means it was distributed around the planet, which for me was a way of trying to get at this, you know, again, decentering the human from themselves to think of themselves as part of a larger global network. So how can we do that? Well, one way would be to put people in one concert hall in dialogue with another concert hall. And so they do that through nomads, typically. And so you'll be interacting with people in Norway, and that just makes you feel kind of more open to the world. So when she's talking about the same air you breathe blows waves across the open Arctic Ocean in Oxalok, when she says that, if you're in the audience and you're linked up with someone in the Arctic, you actually can imagine that the same air you breathe is the same as their air, and you know, we feel more interconnected. And so that whole part of the text has more resonance in a telematic, and it was written for a telematic performance. So in that ways, in those ways, it was very innovative, and it's taken time, I think, for it to start resonating. And Scott and I were talking during the performance last night. Scott leaned over and said, "Well, this sounds like it could have been made, you know, today. Like the what the scientists are saying is just as true then as it is now. It hasn't, you know." That was really interesting. So I think it's, you know, in a way, it's in a better position now, the piece, because it's more kind of widely understood.
But in the time that it took for the world to catch on, and they have, albeit slowly, the climate has changed. Indeed, the very medium from which his music was captured. The earth has gotten warmer, and the environment a piece of music like Oxalock represents has transformed rapidly.
Where I grew up was, it changed faster than the rest of the world because the poles experienced accelerated climate change effects. So, you know, we knew about this stuff in the 90s, and it really hadn't made its way into kind of the popular imagination of the, you know, people further south.
Even if the global population may now perhaps be considered more open to the temporality expressed in Dr. Burtner's climate change opera Oxalock, humans are still way behind the temporal curve. The quantitative data on which Oxalock was based changed significantly since 2012. Dr. Burtner explains it this way.
We hear new reports of, you know, record global warming, record ice loss, Antarctica, the scientists were too, you know, conservative in their estimates of the extent of melting. Greenland, you know, the scientists are always trying to present the information in the kind of most objective way. So they, you know, they usually draw like guidelines, like here's the minimum and the maximum of what we might see, but then they usually repeat the minimum because that's the safe. They know it's going to be at least the minimum. The scientists are always speaking in the minimum, but we need to not do that.
As an artist and activist, Dr. Burtner seeks to change how people imagine themselves in nature and how they conceive of the innate interconnectivity among humans worldwide. Art, as he asserts, plays a significant role and even has a responsibility to promote this.
We humanists, people outside of the scientists, we need to, like, when the scientists give you a maximum, like, we need to look at the maximum. And as an artist, we can do that. We're not, you know, we don't have to, we don't want to be inaccurate, but we want to also be like a warning call to people. And if we keep kind of underestimating and, you know, catering to, you know, the minimum of it, it just gets kind of lost. And, you know, so lately I've seen the role of the arts and humanities as really looking at that whole range and kind of imagining, like, well, what if it's the maximum? Like, they're telling us a range, but let's pretend that they weren't. They were saying it's just that top number, which it seems in terms of climate change, it's always been exceeding the top number. So they, even that range has been conservative in what they report, because they learn new information that says, well, actually it's much further along than that. So, you know, we can start there and make sure that the public imagination is aware of that condition, so that it goes into the imagination of people. And I think that's, you know, in terms of art, science collaboration, that's one of the things that art and in general humanities scholarship can do that as well.
Dr. Burtner then turned to the issue he cares most about, which is, of course, climate change. If Oxalock seemed to be before its time, as he said, then when exactly did people wake up to climate change? As he puts it, climate change is gradual, so abnormal environmental conditions tend to creep into our lives bit by bit. But there was a catalyst that revealed the immediacy of it and the saliency of Oxalock as well.
Probably until, gosh, I really felt like Hurricane Sandy was a big step, because suddenly, you know, you had flooding in Manhattan and major flooding in big urban centers in America, right at the heart of our economy and politics, Washington, D.C. and New York. And that was, you know, I think a wake-up call for a lot of people, even though, you know, we have to kind of like you really have to put like climate deniers on the side, because there's a whole kind of strategy separate from reality that's about economy and, you know, and about resource acquisition that's like on the side. And then, but really normal people just living who thought maybe, well, I don't understand climate change. I don't understand why I care about the Arctic ice melting. Doesn't that just mean it's going to be warmer, you know? Like, they don't really, but then when it starts flooding in New York and they're like, oh, but they said this could never happen. Well, it's going to be very common now, and that's what inundation does. Is it just means that the storm surges every storm season are flooding your city. You can still live there. It's just you live in the flood zone now. And it just keeps coming, and every year, and then it comes every month, and then it's like so frequent, and people just become exhausted with living in a flood zone because your stuff's always getting wet, you know. And I mean, it's really quite simple like that. It's not like the place is going to fall off a cliff or something. It's going to happen gradually over years, and people will just go about their daily lives, and it's pretty soon. Like, I lived in New Orleans for a while, and it was quite common to like wade to class when I was a student there. Wade through like 2 feet of water to get to your class. So we wore, flip-flops and shorts, because you knew you were probably going to be like wading, you know, and so you didn't wear socks, you wear sandals. And I mean, you know, that's just like that became normal. But that's not actually, you know, that's not normal. So I felt like that was a big wake-up call, and all this kind of Arctic science really found its way into the public imagination.
Thank you, as always, for listening to the Joffrion Fellows Time and Temporality podcast. We would like to thank the Humanities Center for making all of this possible, and we would like to thank Dr. Bertner once again for taking the time to speak with us. Please join us next time for a discussion with Dr. Jinan Ismail, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, specializing in the philosophy of physics, metaphysics, philosophy of science, and the philosophy of mind.